Hello, and welcome to episode 39 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. Among other things, I'm formerly incarcerated, a freelance writer, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. In just a few minutes, I'll get to my interview with Janos Martin of the ACLU's Smart Justice Project. Normally, I would do a rundown of everything I've been up to in the last couple of weeks, and it's been pretty busy, but I just want to let everyone know that I am only putting out one more episode after this in 2018. It will come out at the beginning of December, which will give us a round number of 40 episodes for our first year. But don't worry, I've already recorded several episodes for 2019, and I'm very excited by some of the interviews yet to come that I've already set up. Okay, let's get to my interview with Janos Martin. Janos Martin is the state's campaign manager for the Smart Justice campaign at the ACLU. Before joining the ACLU, he was a big part of the Close the Workhouse campaign and also the director of policy and campaigns at Just Leadership USA. And that's really just since I've known him. So I'm guessing there's a lot more I don't know. I've been a huge fan of his work in criminal justice reform for a long time. So it's my pleasure to welcome Janos to the Decarceration Nation podcast. Hello, Janos.
Hey, how are you doing, Josh? Great to be here.
Yeah, great. Thanks so much for coming on. My first question is always the same. Can you flesh out your bio a little bit? How did you end up in criminal justice reform? And can you take us through some of the highlights of your work that you've been a part of?
Sure. Well, criminal justice has always been something that mattered a lot to me. I say, you know, I grew up as a brown kid in Mayor Giuliani's New York City in the 90s. So I was exposed to some of the worst policing practices around, and that always stuck with me, even though I was privileged to have a really great education and have the opportunity to work in politics and get a law degree at Fordham Law School. And it was actually while I was getting my law degree at Fordham where I started a program for 16 and 17-year-olds who were locked up at Rikers Island. That was the first time I ever set foot at that place. And the conditions were just so appalling. And the fact that there were so many at that time, over 600 kids locked up there, that I thought to myself, even as a young person who wasn't at the time very informed about advocacy, how is it possible that we're allowing this to happen in New York City, in this liberal place? Even though my career was sort of peripatetic between law school and Just Leadership, you know, I worked at a civil rights law firm. I worked as a special counsel to an anti-corruption commission. I did police oversight for the city of New York. I always had Rikers in the back of my mind. I stayed involved with this youth program for a number of years afterwards. And one day I decided to go to a new school, a panel discussion about Rikers Island. And I saw a man named Glenn Martin get up and talk about how he was going to lead a campaign to close Rikers Island. And I thought, finally, it's about time that somebody's going to do something about this place. So I didn't get a chance to talk to him after because I had to get back to work. And I looked around my network and tried to figure out how to get connected to Glenn. And as was often the case, I was able to get a hold of Glenn with a meeting 6 weeks later for half an hour in the morning. And by the time I had that meeting with him, he had gotten the first round of funding to actually do a proper Close Rikers campaign. And I went into the conversation thinking I would just volunteer and chip in my time. But within about 48 hours, we decided to work together. And he brought me on as the director of policy and campaigns at Just Leadership. And you know the rest, Josh. It was an amazing few years at Just Leadership, working on the Close Rikers campaign, working on other campaigns like Close MSDF and Free New York and 2 Million Voices. And that's what I was doing until the beginning of 2018 when I went down to St. Louis to try to work with a really awesome group of activists who have been doing work there since Ferguson, if not earlier, on closing the workhouse, which I think is maybe the worst jail in a major city in the United States. And I was in St. Louis for most of 2018 until I got the opportunity to come over to the ACLU, come back to New York, where I'm now the state campaigns manager for Smart Justice. And what that means in practice is that I work with ACLU affiliates around the United States on their criminal justice initiatives.
And so your job now involves traveling around the country and meeting and linking up the ACLU with all the folks working on the ground for criminal justice reform. Is that correct?
That's absolutely a big part of it. I think the ACLU as a whole is, especially since Trump's election, has been thrust into a major sort of resistance lens. And we're trying out advocacy here that has not been done at the organization before in its 100-year history. This is traditionally a big civil rights firm that's done amazing work. But advocacy is new for the organization and for a lot of its state affiliates. And part of the learning curve is learning how to listen to the community and how to center directly impacted leadership. And certainly the places I'm focused is where the local partners are interested in doing that. And I see a big part of my role is making sure that local ACLU affiliates are working with the formerly incarcerated community when it comes to what criminal justice issues we prioritize and how bold we aim. And in addition to that, there's plenty of other nuts and bolts that I'm involved in that are sort of less ideological and more about how we structure really effective campaigns, how we get our messaging down, how we train our organizers, how we run legislative campaigns, and all the things that we need to do to achieve our decarceration goals.
Great. So as we talked about, this is kind of my midterm elections episode. We had the midterms a couple days ago, and I can't think of a better person to talk about some of the criminal justice things that happened. I know the popular press has been calling the election itself a mixed result, but I thought, at least from a criminal justice reform lens, that it was pretty spectacular overall. What were your overall impressions, and where do you think we are as a country in regards to reform after the midterms?
I would love to hear why you think it was spectacular. I thought it was pretty good from a criminal justice standpoint. It was definitely better for criminal justice than it was as far as the straight, D versus R analysis you're seeing. But there were troubling signs as well on the issues that we care about. So I imagine people who listen to your podcast are pretty familiar with the sort of main issues that were on the ballot, like Florida Amendment 4 and Louisiana Amendment 2.
And we'll be talking about each of those in particular in a couple minutes. But
sure. But if we're going to take the other side of the tracks, there was a pretty savage loss on Ohio Issue 1. And, I don't know if it's worth taking a minute now, Josh, but I can talk a little bit about, people have asked, why Florida Amendment 4 passed so overwhelmingly, and yet Ohio Issue 1, which would have reclassified a lot of drug charges, was defeated the way it was. I think the final count was 63% to 37%.
Sure, you can go ahead and if you'd like to talk about why you think one was so successful and the other one wasn't.
Sure, and I mean, great. We can talk about other races too. But Florida was a real masterstroke. I mean, not only was it the product of years of on-the-ground organizing by Desmond Mead and the Florida Rights Restoration, but you also had the resources to run a proper campaign. You had a broad coalition that did include the ACLU. It included Color of Change. The Koch brothers, even they didn't contribute anything financially, but they signaled their support. In Ohio, what you really had is a proxy partisan battle where law enforcement sided very strongly on the no on one side. So you had the Republican candidate for governor blasting Issue 1 in the press. You had former and even current judges blasting the initiative. You had all the law enforcement unions with very sharp and, racist and tough on crime messages out there. And the fact is it worked. Internal polling had it a much closer to a 50-50 race about a month out, 3 weeks out. And at the end of the day, it broke very hard for no. And I think the lesson that I take away from that, when you contrast that to Florida, where for whatever reason, and obviously I'm not inside the minds of Republican operatives in Florida, but for whatever reason, there was never a materialized opposition in Florida to Amendment 4 that we kept thinking might happen. There were definitely people opposed to it, but it would never became a lightning rod issue in Florida the way it did in Ohio. And it just goes to show that in many parts of the country, that sort of racist, tough on crime messaging does work. And I think that's something that we should take note of. It was a very good day for criminal justice. But if you think about some of the issues that won, like Amendment 2 in Louisiana, there was not a vicious, organized law enforcement campaign against Amendment 2. And that the fact that when voters heard the basic messaging from our advocates, they responded well, but they never heard that savage counter message the way they did in Ohio. And when they did hear it in Ohio, they responded a certain way.
All right. I want to push back just a little bit on what you said about Amendment 4 in Florida. From my perspective, it was a huge victory. I'm very excited to see so many people got the right to vote. But for many of us who are, for instance, registrants, we feel a little bit like we've been sacrificed. And the reason why that I would say that is because in a lot of instances, carve-outs happen and we talk about incremental change, but it's very hard to see where the increment of change occurs after this for the people who are left behind in Amendment 4, because it's a constitutional amendment and a new constitutional amendment would have to be passed that was essentially just for people who have been sentenced for murder or sex offenses. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. And I really do appreciate you being a voice raising that in the last few weeks. I think it's a really important point. I will say that on a personal and professional level, you know, I wasn't involved in, and I actually don't even really know what the exact point was, the decision point was around those exclusions. You know, and certainly I'm somebody who supports universal suffrage. I think everybody, and by the way, I mean, that's universal suffrage is pretty far from Amendment 4 in general, right? We have a long way to go before people in this country who are in jail and in prison serving their sentences have the right to vote. And that's something that I hope we make some progress on in the years ahead. In terms of those exclusions, I definitely wish I knew more about the thinking behind it. But certainly by the time I became sort of tangentially involved in this race, that decision had been made. And so I think it's an appropriate critique. I will say that there was a time.
Yeah. So my point wasn't really that incrementalism is bad. I support incrementalism, and I certainly have supported plenty of legislation with carve-outs. I think the concern is that there isn't an increment left, that there really isn't a path forward for anyone who's left behind in this particular legislation. I won't continue to belabor the point, but I just wanted to see, you know, if you had any more thoughts, and then we'll move on.
Oh, well, I only have one to that point, which is I do think that if you look at Demand 10 from the Nationwide Prison Strike, right, which is universal suffrage, I think that's a conversation that, as I just said, is a ways away from happening in Florida, perhaps, definitely at this political moment. But if you look at New York, for example, there's going to be a voting rights set of bills that are going to come through in 2019. And universal suffrage, there are going to be people who are going to inject it into the conversation. We'll see its viability in a place like New York. But, I mean, that is the next step, right? I mean, like, I think that conversation, to the extent it's been happening, has happened without carve-outs. And I think hopefully, there'll be enormous pushback from some circles. But I think the fact that we have two states, even though they're two small white New England states that have universal suffrage, does push back on the narrative, like, well, how could you extend the right to vote to those people? It's like, well, actually, we've done it for hundreds of years in these two places in the United States. We're not even looking at some Scandinavian, dream model. This is these are two.
That's Vermont and Maine. That's right.
That's right. Yeah. And so that's the only, recognizing your point, that's the only counterpoint I'd make, is that once we actually get into the conversation on universal suffrage, it's a chance to revisit this whole issue.
All right. Given some of your work on closing jails, how have you felt about what happened in Colorado?
With Amendment Day?
Yes.
Yeah, I thought that was, I have to be honest, that's not a race that I had followed closely until quite recently. And I was pretty pleased that that went overwhelmingly yes. It was 65-35. And we'll see how it actually is manifested in real life now that it's been passed. I'm very curious as to how the state is going to respond to that. I realized, Josh, that in my talking about races that mattered, I did skip over a set of district attorney races. And I'd be happy to jump into some of those as well.
Sure. If there's any particular races you'd like to talk about, that would be great.
Yeah. So in terms of whether this was a good night or a bad night for criminal justice, I do think that it was a fairly promising night using the lens of district attorney races. So In Dallas, you had Cruzo, who ran on a decarceration platform, actually a fairly explicit one, 20% decarceration in Cruzo's first year, overwhelmingly defeated the incumbent, who was a Republican in Dallas County, but a Republican who was actually backed by a fair number of Democrats. So was very much the sort of establishment candidate, was defeated 60-40. So that was a really positive outcome in Texas. In Chesterfield County, Virginia, we had an open seat for district attorney with a really horrific DA leaving office, and the more progressive candidate won there. We had Rollins and Wesley Bell, actually, you know, their races were pretty much uncontested, but they've formally taken office after their victories last night. And then there were a couple losses that, you know, even though they were disappointing, they still showed an appetite for reform. So in Hennepin County, Minnesota, which is the most heavily incarcerated county in that state, the incumbent of many years was challenged and nearly defeated. And even in Oklahoma, in Logan and Payne counties, where you had a candidate, Williams, who ran on an unabashedly progressive platform as a Democrat in Oklahoma, a state where all 77 counties vote Republican, the challenger lost 56-44. So I think that it just goes to show that the DA races, I've heard the pushback. There are some who say that, look, you know, progressive district attorneys are still district attorneys, they're still prosecutors. It might not be the best use of movement resources. But I do think that these races all show that there is an appetite for change in that space. And frankly, you know, even a half positive district attorney can make a huge difference in the number of people's lives in terms of reducing the number of people who are in jail and how long they're held pretrial and all of those things. And finally, in New York, this may seem like a minor race, but in Rensselaer County, which is just north of Albany, District Attorney Abe Love was defeated by the challenger. District Attorney Abe Love had been one of the worst district attorneys in New York State. So overall, it lends credence to your point that it was a fantastic evening, at least in that respect.
Yeah, I believe in radical incrementalism, which is to say that I do believe that, for instance, prosecutors who control a great deal of the amount of incarceration that happens and the choices that are made, that it's really important to move toward more progressive prosecutors. And sure, it might be true that in the end result, those prosecutors end up still prosecuting some people. That's mm-hmm. still going to be a massive improvement, probably. It certainly, for instance, in Philadelphia has been, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, and Philadelphia is really instructive for a couple of reasons. One, you know, it seems like a long time ago. Actually, it was, you know, not that long ago when Larry Krasner, who was elected with the support of the grassroots community in Philadelphia, including groups led by formerly incarcerated people, not only was he elected with those folks supporting him, but those groups have continued to hold him accountable since the election. There's an accountability working group that has been pushing him on a number of issues, on staffing issues, since he took office. And I think now that we have a whole new crop of so-called progressive prosecutors, we should be getting better at holding them accountable across the country. And I think that's a trend that'll just continue. You know, there's a lot of money in this space too. There's a lot of new foundations, especially out of California, who are interested in this issue. So I think we're going to continue to see progressive prosecutors being something that people talk about in the election context. And my hope is that we continue to talk about it in the post-election context. How do we hold prosecutors accountable to the promises they made during the campaign?
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing. So do you have any thoughts about, for instance, what happened in Louisiana?
Sure. Well, so for listeners, this is Amendment 2, which would require unanimous juries rather than the 10 out of 12 system that they had before, which along with Oregon, I believe were the only two states in which you could convict somebody with 10 out of 12. And so this is unequivocal good, right? This is a really good that Amendment 2 passed. It passed 64-36. And that's a really positive sign. One of my colleagues, Dashika Ruffin here at the ACLU, worked really intensely on that campaign. And I do think this is an example of, you know, we were talking about Ohio issue one earlier and Florida Amendment 4. This was a race that until fairly close to the end was a little bit under the radar. I think that criminal justice advocates were able to shape the narrative around this race in a really constructive way. And they were able to do so without really vicious pushback from law enforcement and other right-wing criminal law enforcement forces. And so for that reason, I think it was able to pass comfortably. And so I think it's an unalloyed good that it passed, and hopefully will continue to bring down decarcerate Louisiana, which, by the way, I mean, Louisiana is going to continue to be a focal point of criminal justice reform over the next couple of years. I mean, they have a New Orleans district attorney race coming up in 2020. And then very importantly, the governor is up in 2019. Now, this is a governor who passed a host of criminal justice reforms in the last few years, and will be facing a challenger, a Republican challenger, who has been extremely critical of those criminal justice reforms. And criminal justice may well be the referendum on which Louisiana race is decided next year. So this is a really important state. I think for everybody who is involved in this work probably knows that for a long time, Louisiana was the worst incarcerator by percentage in the United States. And it's now moved all the way up to 49th or 48th, depending on how you measure it. So this is a really important moment for the movement to make sure that we don't lose the gains that have been made in Louisiana.
And then we also had the state of Washington passing Initiative 940 about use of force standards and training for police.
Washington was also a really encouraging result. I think the criminal justice reform community and abolitionists often are like cousins of the police reform movement. We do some work together, but not enough. I know that from my experience in New York and in St. Louis, and even here at the ACLU, it sometimes can be siloed, but ultimately policing practices are where mass incarceration begins. People's first arrests, people accumulating their records at the hands of over-aggressive and often racist policing practices. And the fact of the matter is the reason those practices continue is because mayors and county executives and governors and sheriffs and district attorneys all feel like police are unassailable politically. So the fact that you actually have a ballot initiative that would be opposed by a police union pass is a extremely encouraging sign, I think, and hopefully will give more courage to elected officials to actually challenge wrongful policing practices under them.
I also think, although I'm not particularly a user myself, that Tuesday was a pretty good day for marijuana users and sellers. Would you agree?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Michigan being the basically leading off the Midwest legalization effort. That was a really good result. I actually am not, I don't follow legalization very closely, so I'm not sure what other initiatives passed on Tuesday night, but Michigan is one that I was following because legalization movements have had so much success on the coasts. And I've always said that it'll be, once we have a legalization where you can actually drive from one side of the country to the other through legal states, that'll be an interesting time because that'll cause all kinds of havoc for people in the federal government who are still looking to undermine this stuff.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of times, especially over the last several Republican administrations, where a lot of times, despite their professed love for federalism, where the federal government would try to impose federal requirements on the states. Is that not correct?
Absolutely. Well, it's just another example of hypocrisy, right? You know, let the states do their own thing unless it's relating to weed or gay marriage or... or the woman's right to choose, whatever it may be. Yeah.
Okay, I think now we've talked about a bunch of the good. One of the things I thought was bad, it seems like Marcy's Law is passed in six states. For me, I do think we should certainly protect victims, but not in ways that prevent or corrupt the exercise of due process. It seems to me this bill seriously misunderstood how rights, at least in a court context, work. Do you have any thoughts about Marcy's Law?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right to raise both the substantive problems of Marcy's Law and the political challenge that Marcy's Law raises. There's now been, a number of states that have passed it. I actually, unfortunately, don't have the number off the top of my head, but Marcy's Law's track record as a political issue is extremely strong. It almost always wins. It's an extremely well-funded initiative. And I think, we'll see how it actually manifests in court practice, in the years ahead, but it's going to be very difficult to push back on, victims' rights lobbyists, because, when you think about the politics of it, it's an extremely sympathetic group of people. And as you said, who possibly could be opposed to, victims' rights in the abstract. So it's a very challenging issue, and I have not had the opportunity to work on an effort to, you know, oppose it myself, but I have seen that it's generally extremely well received in state capitals. It does really well on the ballot box. So something that the movement should be very aware of and hypervigilant about in the years ahead.
Yeah, as a civil libertarian myself, I feel the real problem is that in these generally the problem is in court is that rights generally protect you from your liberty being suspended by government, and laws like this help the government suspend liberty. So it almost seems anti-constitutional to me in a lot of ways, which is a bit disturbing to me.
The other thing that's troubling about Marcy's law is that it continues this bifurcated notion of victims versus offenders. And I think that people who work in the criminal justice space, in fact, people who just work in community spaces in general, know that it's not so rigid and clear a line, and that many people who are system labels as offenders have also been victims. And the people who are most likely to be victims of crimes are the same people who have been marginalized economically and socially by our government, by our policies. And so this idea that we have a victims' rights movement that actually works to the detriment of defendants in our criminal justice system, it's just out of step with how we know life really works.
Yeah, I think that's fair. We talked a little bit about Ohio before, and you seem to think that the main reason that Ohio probably didn't succeed is there wasn't enough organizing and long-term organizing. I found that election or that issue to be a little bit strange because there's been so much opioid problem in Ohio. Why do you think, or if I don't know if you have any thoughts about this, but why do you think it's been so hard, given the failure of the war on drugs in states like this, to get the message across, even despite pushback from law enforcement?
You know, I don't think there was ever a moment in the Issue One campaign in Ohio where the pro Issue One folks had a substantial lead, or there was, you know, overwhelming support for it. It was always going to be close, because ultimately, you know, the opioid crisis is immensely complicated, and there is, for all of its ineffectiveness, still a very strong, tough on crime, you know, arrest our way out of it perspective that is pervasive in a lot of communities. And so I do think the fact that there's such a terrible opioid crisis in Ohio and in so much of the Rust Belt, you'd think that would counsel in favor of people being more open-minded about different approaches to the war on drugs. But I think it does cut both ways. I think there are some people who are more open-minded than other people who rely on this sort of traditional war on drugs, tough on crime, you know, why are we coddling drug dealers rhetoric. But ultimately, you know, as somebody who is not involved in Ohio Issue One, but did sort of watch it from afar, I had access to some conversations that were happening around it. It was much closer than the results suggest until the last few weeks of the election. It was always something that was pretty 50-50, or maybe, you know, 45-55 polling for most of the year. But then the late blitz of law enforcement really scaring people around what it meant and distorting it was effective. And so I do think, of course, always more organizing helps, more money helps, more investment from the field helps. But at the end of the day, this is a message of fear succeeded. And I think that's something that we have to take note of. You know, in many urban areas, especially on the coasts and especially in blue states, you do have conversations happening around who can be the better criminal justice reform advocate. It happened in many of the district attorney races we talked about earlier. But, you know, in the heartland, tough on crime, you know, racist rhetoric, fear-mongering, it works. It works politically. And so that means we still have to do a lot of work in crafting a narrative around who is impacted by the criminal justice system and better uses of our resources as a society. But we just have a lot more work to do in a place like Ohio.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I always ask the same question every time at the end. What did I mess up? What question should I have asked but didn't?
Oh, well, I guess, you know, we did a nice recap of election night, but there is some question about, like, what's next, what we should look forward to coming out of election night based on things that have changed. I am very excited to talk just for a minute about Wisconsin.
Great. Time, Mike. Yeah.
So Scott Walker was a foe of many folks in various advocacy communities, but on criminal justice, he was also absolutely a regressive person who wanted to spend more money on prisons and lock more people up. And his defeat on election night is significant because his opponent, Anthony Evers, the new governor of Wisconsin, has made a pledge during one of his Democratic primary debates that was hosted by Expo and Wisdom in Wisconsin to close the Milwaukee Secure Detention Facility. Now, Close MSDF has been a campaign that formerly incarcerated advocates have been pushing for the last couple of years, and it's something that the governor has authority to do. The area of crimeless revocation is something that the governor can do a lot, even without legislative support. So in Wisconsin, we very well may see the triumph of a grassroots, formerly incarcerated-led campaign, and that would result in closing a prison. And obviously, we're not there yet. Obviously, campaign promises are just promises. But coming out of election night, I'm certainly very focused on that particular advocacy campaign, and I look forward to working with people like Mark Rice, who's been a campaign leader at Expo for a long time, on getting that over the finish line. And then in your home state, Josh, we've got bail reform is going to be on the docket under the new governor. You know, bail reform can always go sideways down the stretch, as yes. We saw in California. But
I'm actually on a lot of the task forces for that here. So,
hey, I'm optimistic that I'm feeling good about our chances. You know, nothing is ever a done deal, especially with bail. But I think Michigan is really promising. And New York.
Hopefully, we're also going to be working on expungement.
Absolutely. And then in New York, the state Senate flipped from Republican to Democrat. Republican state senators had long held up the criminal justice reforms sought in New York, like bail, speedy trial, discovery reform. And so, again, nothing's a done deal. It's a lot of herding cats. There's always the specter of the governor resisting. But election night was very significant in giving the New York state Senate over to control of the state Senate over to people who have long talked about passing criminal justice reform.
Well, that's a bunch of good news there at the end to end with. And I really appreciate you taking the time. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, Janos. And I hope you thanks so much for doing this again.
Absolutely. Happy to be on. Congratulations on cranking out so many episodes, and look forward to listening to you over the next few months into 2019.
Thanks so much. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Now my take. Early in our conversation, Janos asked me why I felt it was such a good election for criminal justice reform. I suppose it's because a couple of years ago, right after the 2016 election, I sat at a table in my church in a room full of traumatized and devastated people who were all wondering what in the world was next for all of us. And at that moment, it was barely conceivable that we could flip the House in 2 years, flip state legislatures, roll back political gerrymandering in several states, not to mention all of the criminal justice reform legislation that Janos and I just discussed. But it isn't just that. How far have we come in just the last 8 years? When I was arrested in 2010, it would have been inconceivable for a state to vote to end prison slavery, for instance, as Colorado just did. I mean, even using that language probably would have been controversial. For another state to give back the vote to over a million people with felony convictions, and I know I have some issues with the way that bill went down, but I'm extremely happy that over a million people in Florida who are formerly incarcerated can now vote. That is a major victory. You know, we've come a long way in a very short time. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, we obviously still have a long way to go yet. We have so much work left to do. But it's hard to say we haven't made massive progress in changing the public discussion from tough on crime to smart on crime, from tough on crime to restorative justice, from tough on crime to just trying to make return for people who have been incarcerated more sensible, that I have a lot of hope for the future. You know, I really appreciate Janos coming on. You know, he has been a real warrior across the country for years in terms of making sure that things happen, and been a real big part of changing the dialogue all over the place on these issues. Anyway, as always, you can find the show notes or leave us comments on decarcerationnation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/onpiratesatellite. You can also support us by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes or like us on Stitcher or Spotify. Special thanks to Andrew Stein, who does the editing and post-production for me. Thanks so much for listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. And don't forget, we have one more episode coming in 2018. See you next time.